This is The Blade and Beyond with the DC Dynamic Duo. Learn every detail about life on both ends of the knife. And now, live from Washington, D.C., your hosts, board-certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. Michael Salmanik, and board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Troy Pittman.
Hello, everybody. Happy Sunday. It is Sunday, October 9th. I'm Dr. Troy Pittman. Welcome to The Blade and Beyond.
I am Dr. Michael Salmanik. Welcome, welcome, everyone.
So it's episode 2, and I have to say I'm so excited because episode 1 last week was the, or 2 weeks ago,
yes,
was the most listened to episode of our podcast ever.
Woohoo! So, cue the confetti and everything else.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. So, you're dying. I can see it in your face. You're dying to talk about Kygo.
I am. Well, you know, the past 2 weeks, we had a little bit of travel that complicated the recording last week. But during the week, we went to New York on Thursday night to see Kygo, who...
At Madison Square Garden, is amazing.
And who I'm mildly obsessed with. I think that his music is amazing. I do listen to it, unfortunately, kind of nonstop. So for those that work with me in the operating room, God bless, because they probably know the songs by heart just as much as I do at this point. But went to Madison Square Garden. We saw an amazing performance. He played every song I possibly could have wanted, had live singers.
Well, what was so great is all the singers that he collaborates with came and they were singing live.
Ugh, it was so good. Like the quality, the confetti, the streamers that he had, just like some of the effects and the pyrotechnics, just like everything came together. We had really good seats, which I was so happy about.
And if anybody wants to know how happy he was, I'm going to play this clip because I have this clip of I was recording on my phone the number, but in the background, all I can hear is you screaming and yelling and going, oh my God, over and over again.
I mean, clearly I was excited.
I don't even know if you can hear it, but you're going, this is amazing. Oh my God. It was very funny.
Yeah, you were in charge of recording everything because I just was really wanting to enjoy the night without having to worry about my phone and filming things. So thank you for capturing those timeless moments.
I was the resident videographer, as always.
Yes, but we had a great time. Thank you for coming with me and enjoying Kygo.
And then we rushed home to get our COVID vaccines, which, you know, every time I get the vaccine, I get so sick for about 12 hours where I wake up in the morning. I woke up this morning. I got it yesterday. I woke up this morning. I felt like I was dying. Every joint in my body was aching. My arm felt like it was going to fall off. But every time I get the vaccine, I think, thank God that this is not going to last for 2 weeks. I mean, I can't imagine having actual COVID.
No.
It's pretty bad.
No, I'm happy we got it. We always sort of dread getting it because out of all vaccines, this one does give you a little bit of a reaction. I typically don't get as intensive a reaction as you do, but I took a little Advil. I did feel a little achy this morning, but it seems to have passed.
We're
and
over
I
it.
Feel
We're healed.
Fine. And I'm glad it's just done for, who knows, maybe the
Six
year
months.
Now? I don't know. We'll see what the next recommendation is come midwinter or early spring or whatever it may be.
Well, if you haven't gotten your flu shot, get your flu shot. If you haven't had your COVID vaccine booster, get your booster. Just do it. So that's our public service announcement. So first, it is October. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I wanted to talk a little bit today about mammogram myths, because for a lot of women, they use October as kind of their reminder that it's time to get a mammogram. And all day long, I hear patients tell me all of the reasons why they haven't had their mammogram. So I wanted to go through some of the myths. I think you have a whole list here.
Yes, I've created a little list for you that I'm surprising you with. So you're going to have to break them down. Let's start with the first one. Self-breast exams are as good as mammograms.
Okay, so that one is, that's false. What's interesting is a mammogram can show an abnormality in the breast 2 years before there's a palpable lump. And so women should be doing monthly self-breast exams, but if we want to really have early detection, you still need to have a mammogram.
Yeah, the self-exams are basically to feel like a palpable lump, not something that perhaps they'll see microscopic changes on the mammogram, right? All right, so mammograms expose you to dangerous radiation.
So that's also not true. We are being exposed to radiation every single day. Background radiation. The doses of radiation with a mammogram are very, very low. They're within the FDA standard of mammogram of radiation exposure. So that is also false.
The next one is, I only need a mammogram if I feel a lump.
So that goes back to the
original one.
If you feel a lump, obviously you're going to also have a little bit of a different kind of mammogram. So women who go and have their yearly mammograms have screening mammograms. Women who feel a lump, who go get a mammogram, have what's called a diagnostic mammogram, where they actually will do specific imaging on the lump in question, as well as the breast. So it's a little bit of a different test.
More views.
Yes. Well, or more compressive views. They can zoom in with a 3D mammogram to really look at the area of concern. They may do an ultrasound.
Do they really flatten the breast out? This isn't a myth, I'm asking. Out like a pancake?
Not, well, I mean, I guess it depends on how dense the breast is, but they're trying to obviously put x-rays through the breast. And so the flatter the breast, the easier it is to image the breast. But we're going to get to dense breasts in a second.
Okay. I do have something to add on that too. I don't need to worry because I have no family history.
That's absolutely not true. We know that 85% of breast cancers that are diagnosed are in women who have no family history.
Wow. So that's high.
That is definitely a myth.
Okay. So only older women need mammograms.
I hate this one. Why? So 1 in 6 women who are going to be diagnosed with breast cancer are between the age of 40 and 50.
Young.
Which is really crazy. And women in their 40s actually who are diagnosed, those tend to be more aggressive cancers. And so we're seeing a lot more breast cancer in women in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Mm. This is not a grandma disease. It can be, but certainly this is not something that only older women are getting, although the older you get, the higher your risk of breast cancer.
So no family history. When do I need a mammogram?
So the screening guideline is all women who do not have a family history start getting their first mammogram at age 40.
40, okay.
The other guideline is if you have a family history, you get your first mammogram 10 years before your first degree relative. So let's say your mother has breast cancer. She was diagnosed at 40. You would then get your first mammogram at age 30. That's the guideline.
Okay. This one is interesting. Women with dense breasts need more than a mammogram.
So dense breasts, it's really amazing. This month, Katie Couric came out said that she has she's been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she talked about dense breasts. And really, this isn't something that's gotten a lot of attention. Women who have dense breasts, generally the density of the breast is because they have more breast tissue in their breast. And so women with dense breasts are statistically more at risk for developing breast cancer because they have more breast glandular tissue. The breast is made up of glandular tissue and fat. And so a woman with a dense breast has more glandular tissue. And because a mammogram is really an x-ray, when you put the x-ray beams through the breast, the density of the breast comes up as white on the mammogram. But a tumor also can come up as white. And so women with dense breasts shouldn't just be getting their mammogram. They also may need to get a 3D mammogram.
3D.
So a 3D mammogram allows the mammographers to really kind of look into and around the breast tissue. Whereas a traditional mammogram, it goes top to bottom, side to side. That's two compressive views. A 3D mammogram takes more, but we also have automated breast ultrasound where they can do a 3D reconstruction of the breast and really look within the breast to differentiate dense breast tissue from something of concern. And then obviously the gold standard and the best way to diagnose breast cancer is with MRI.
I saw that segment and she talked about dense breasts, and it is a radiologic diagnosis, not something like you can't feel a breast and say your breast is dense.
That's not true. So
that's what she said, though.
Well, Katie Couric is wrong, because you can feel.
Maybe you can tweet her.
You can feel dense breasts. You know, when I am examining a woman in the office, I can tell who has dense breasts and who doesn't, because the breast tends to be firmer on exam. It tends to be perkier. And so when I see a woman who maybe is in her 50s or 60s who has really perfect, perky breasts, that's telling me that there's a lot more glandular tissue. As women get older, that glandular tissue turns to fat. But you can definitely tell dense breasts by feeling them.
Yeah, she gave a really good segment. I enjoyed it, actually. And it sounds like they caught her cancer early. So
yeah, that's great.
Breast implants interfere with mammograms.
So this is mostly false. There is a little bit of truth to the fact that a breast implant can obscure the views. So like I said, most mammograms, it's side to side and up and down. That's where the beams are going into the breast. So obviously a breast implant can obscure being able to see from one side of the breast to the other side of the breast. However, if you're going to get a mammogram and you have breast implants, it's important, even when you schedule your appointment, just to tell the radiology office that you have breast implants, because what they're going to do is what's called an Eklund view. So instead of just doing those traditional side-to-side, up-and-down views, they're going to do displacement views, where they actually displace the breast tissue away from the breast implant, to kind of isolate the breast tissue away from the breast implant. And so
that's got to be difficult to do.
It can be challenging, particularly in women who have their implants placed above the muscle rather than under the muscle. But there are going to be those extra four views. So it's two extra views in each breast for women with breast implants.
Saline or silicone difference?
There's no difference. So they're going to still do Eklund views and special imaging with both.
Women with implants are at higher risk for breast cancer.
That is absolutely
such a controversial statement.
That's absolutely not true. You know, breast cancer is the second most common cause of breast cancer in women. Second most common cause of cancer in women after skin cancer. And breast implants have nothing to do with who's going to be diagnosed with breast cancer. Now, obviously, we've talked about this on the podcast before. There is a newer entity called BIA-ALCL, which is a type of lymphoma that can form around breast implants, but that is not breast cancer. So right. When we're talking about breast cancer and breast implants are two totally different subjects. Breast implants do not cause breast cancer.
Very important distinction. The last one is that, this is the one that I would worry about, mammograms will rupture my implants. I'd be like, listen, tech, don't push too hard on this implant.
Yeah. So the new generation, the fifth generation gummy bear implants, most of these implants you could roll over with your car and you would not rupture the implant.
Oh, God.
Now, obviously, there have been many women, particularly with saline implants, who have had their implants ruptured with a mammogram. But I think as implant technology has improved, the chances of that happening are much, much less. So there's only about 30 pounds of pressure that are put on the breast in a mammogram, which is certainly not enough to rupture an implant.
Okay, well, that concludes our myths. I think that was very helpful. I learned a lot.
I hope so.
And yes, because it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I hope everyone benefited from that.
Well, thank you.
Okay, we kind of touched on screening guidelines with everything.
Age 40. Or 10 years before your first degree relative was diagnosed, you need to get your mammogram once a year. Try and do it the same time every year. Do your monthly self-breast exams. If you have breast implants, make sure you're following up with a board-certified plastic surgeon. That's it.
Okay. Well, we are going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about...
In the news.
So okay. There is a new toxin on the market, a new botulinum toxin called Daxxify is what they ultimately decided to name it. And it has been, we've been hearing about this for like, God, 5-6 years. And there's been so many hurdles that this company, Revance is the company, has had to jump through. Because the FDA went to look at their factory a couple of years ago and was like, there's some cleanliness issues and whatnot. They've obviously overcome those. It's now FDA approved.
So let's start by saying, what makes this different than Botox?
I'm going to get to that. Wait for it. So it is a neuromodulator. It's just like your Botox and all of that stuff. It is, well, I'll take a step back now. Most of those neuromodulators, like your Botox, your Xeomin, and your Dysport, and even Jeuveau, are linked with like a human serum albumin.
You're being way too smart.
No,
just
I'm not.
Tell us.
They have a human product. So this one is only protein-based, non-human protein-based.
Okay.
And so the studies have shown that it has actually lasted longer than the standard. So about 50% of the people in the study, and this is several thousand people, saw up to 6 months duration, which we typically see 3 to 4 months max with the current neuromodulators, which is really promising, right? So it sounds like an amazing thing. Why would we not use it, et cetera? I think there's still a few things that we need to figure out. One is, what if you come to see me and I say, this is the new one. It's going to last longer than, you know, your Dysport or your Botox treatment that you've previously gotten. And you come back to me in 3 months and your movement is back just like if you got your previous injections.
Well, and we see patients with any of the neuromodulators. I mean, it is obviously, it's totally variable. So we say, okay, this is going to last 3 months. And they come back in 2 months and they say, I feel like I have movement back. But there's also, I feel like it's so subjective. And so I think that some tolerability exists, different tolerability exists with all patients. So if you want your forehead to be totally frozen, you may come back in 3 months and say, I want to be totally frozen. I'm not totally frozen.
However, this is going to cost more to not only the injector, but the patient.
Right, because so, you're going to be getting it half as often.
Well, it's a new product. It's not even half as often. It's the fact that, number one, it's a new product, and yes, it's a different technology. So that company is expecting to make money on that, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of promise with it, but we don't even know how much. They're still waiting to unveil that. And I've spoken to the company. They're still kind of in the works with giving us the price point for it.
Yeah, so we don't even know. Pricing is going to be one of the big issues. And I think also telling someone this can last 6-7 months when it doesn't, or when the patient doesn't think that it's lasted as long as they thought, I don't know. I'm a little bit.
As someone that participates in FDA trials, specifically with neuromodulators, I can tell you that it's a very specific face cue or questionnaire that we use to determine how much movement somebody has with very standardized imaging. So I think that they can pretty confidently say that 50% or up to 50% of these people saw duration of up to 6 months. But yeah, we're going to have to see clinically how it plays out. And once we start using it, we're absolutely going to get it. We are going to use it. But I mean, I, like you, are probably going to want to use it on maybe some of our office staff, maybe on ourselves, to determine the true longevity of it, at least from our perspective. And moving forward, we'll be able to say, okay, this worked this long on us. In the studies, it showed this, because it doesn't always correlate with the studies showed, strangely.
Well, the other thing that I think everyone probably needs to be aware of when you're doing this is there are side effects to all of these medicines. And so if you are getting Dysport or you're getting Botox and your eyelid droops, you kind of know that that's going to resolve in 3 to 4 months, presumably. if you have long-acting botulinum toxin and you have a complication, it's going to be with you for a long time.
Well, there's that as well. They didn't show any increased side effect profile in comparison to the other neuromodulators out there. So, but you're right. If you get a ptosis or an eyelid droop, you potentially are stuck with it a little bit longer than we traditionally think, that 2 to 3 month duration.
I don't know. Is it that big of a deal to come in every 3 or 4 months to get your forehead de-wrinkled?
It's going to appeal to a specific patient population.
Yeah.
Like everything else. Okay. So more to come on that. We'll update you once we have a little bit more clarity on it, once we start carrying it, once we've experienced it for ourselves.
Okay, we are almost to Halloween, so it's time to talk about fall skincare.
Yes.
Laser, laser, laser.
It is my favorite time of year for many reasons. I love fall. I love cooking.
I love a laser.
I'm actively making a soup right now, but I love lasers. And this is the time because many of us have traveled all summer. We've gone to Europe or the beach or the Caribbean. And despite our best abilities with sunscreen coverage, we've gotten some cumulative sun damage on our skin.
Okay, so I broke this down into we're giving you a little test.
Okay, tell me.
So I've broken this into three devices. And because everyone's always asking, what should I get? And they look on the internet and they get very confused. So tell us about IPL and what that is and who should be getting IPL this fall.
IPL stands for Intense Pulse Light. It is a light-based treatment. Although we pair it with lasers all the time, it's actually not a laser. It is amazing to lift off sun damage that we all have on our skin, in addition to potentially treating some of the reds that some people have, like rosacea, or just underlying redness that we have to even out our skin, or we use it to even out our skin tone. So I really think everyone is a candidate for IPL.
I think, for like sunspots, right?
Right, for sunspots. Who is it not appropriate for? Someone with a lot of wrinkles on their face that's looking to get rid of those. That's not what IPL is for.
Or really dark patients.
That's right. So your darker Hispanics, African Americans, you know, we have a Fitzpatrick skin type scale that we use to categorize people into a specific category. And those 4s through 6s, which are your darker skin types, are not candidates. Because think about it, it sees sunspots, it sees color, the browns.
Color versus not color.
And so if you're trying to lift browns off, you could potentially cause burns, scars, and other long-lasting damage on your darker skin types. So not appropriate for darker skin types, unfortunately.
Okay. Microneedling with radio frequency.
Oh, I'm due for that treatment.
We're not talking about you.
I know, but I love it. I love all of these, but microneedling radio frequency is something you should be doing maybe every 6 months or so. It's great for collagen stimulation. Essentially, those microneedles are going into the skin. They're going to the level of the skin called the dermis that produces collagen, and it's emitting radio frequency in the form of heat. So potentially over time, you see nice skin tightening, evening, and reduction of wrinkles.
And pore
size reduction.
Sure.
Very limited downtime for people that are interested in kind of getting back out there, getting back to work, wearing makeup. Maybe 48 hours, I tell most patients. The skin's still not going to be fully recovered, but you could cover it up.
Okay. CO2 laser.
I feel like you're rushing me through these. I'm sweating. So
this is what you did with me with the mammograms.
No, it's not. The CO2 laser is the most aggressive treatment, but the most thorough treatment. It is truly going to resurface your skin, remodel the integrity of the skin to smooth it out, get rid of superficial lines and wrinkles, and even your deeper lines and wrinkles. We see marked reduction. And what's great about it is, sure, you carry with it the 7 to 10 days of downtime for a true resurfacing patient. However, 2-3 months down the line, after you've healed and you've kind of forgotten about it, your skin starts even looking better and better because that underlying collagenesis that the laser stimulated, it really starts to create a better, improved appearance over time. This is why I love it.
CO2 laser also can get rid of a lot of that sun damage as well.
It can. I actually love to pair the CO2 with IPL. I do an IPL layer first.
Just to get some of that pigment.
Exactly. And then the CO2 really blasts it out. Mm-hmm. So when these people recover, they're amazed by how their skin looks. Now, keep in mind with the CO2, we don't have to treat you say I'm treating you. I wouldn't treat you with the true resurfacing setting that I'm looking to treat someone with deeper lines and wrinkles. I can dial the energy down. I can do what we consider, what we call the CO2 light treatment.
Which is more like a chemical peel.
Kind of. And it's limited downtime. It's even less downtime than a chemical peel. I love it more than a chemical peel because you're not peeling from it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have patients come to me all the time, I talk to them in the office about CO2 laser. They go home, they Google CO2 lasering. And why are you looking at your phone?
Because my timer is going to go off and it's telling me I need to turn the oven up. So don't worry about it.
Okay. What are you cooking?
I'm cooking this Polish dish with cabbage and sausage.
Super. So, but a lot of patients, we talk about CO2 laser in the office. They go home, they Google CO2 laser.
Yes.
And they see the CO2 laser of the 80s and 90s where people
burn look victims. Like
they've been burned.
Yes.
So how is this different?
Because these lasers that we have now, the CO2 specifically is fractionated. So that means that when I aim the laser beam at your skin and it creates a grid on your skin, not 100% of that grid is being treated with the CO2 laser. There are actually zones that are unaffected. And so that's where the fractionated component comes in, which means those healthy, untouched layers can recruit cells much more quickly, leading to a faster recovery.
As far as in office versus in the operating room, IPL.
I mean, we do it all the time in the office. For me, if I had my choice, I'd be asleep for it every time.
I think it's the worst of all of what we do. I mean, for me.
But you know what the results are. You stick with it. It doesn't last long. And when it's over, you kind of forget about it and you go about your day.
Microneedling with radio frequency in the office or in the
OR? In the office. Numbing cream works amazing. It's not a horrible treatment. I've had it maybe like 5-6 times now. And you get through it. I always liken it to like, I don't know if this is PC, but like Chinese water torture. Like the first half of
that's pleasant.
Well, no, listen, because the first half of the face, you're like, okay, I can get through this. But then after like the 100th microneedle pulse on the skin, you're like, okay, this is getting a little bit annoying and I'm starting to feel a little bit more. And then by the time you're done, you're ready to be done.
Yeah. I mean, and also we can give you a little Pronox, which is a little inhaled nitrous oxide, which helps with that.
In addition to the numbing.
CO2 laser, office, OR.
So the CO2 light that we talked about with the limited downtime, you can easily do in the office. Numbing cream works beautifully for it. It is not super painful. It's over in about 10, 15 minutes. You go home, that's it.
But for someone who wants to get the most bang for their buck.
The resurfacing setting, you got to be asleep. It is not even worth it to stay awake for it. It's painful. It's I think it's traumatic in my
eyes. I mean, the thing is to put things into perspective. When you're doing it in the office for the chemical peel type CO2 laser, we're doing it on 12 or 15.
Yes.
Whereas in the OR, we're doing it at like 95.
That's right.
So that gives you kind of an idea of what that is. Okay. Clear and Brilliant.
Clear and Brilliant is an amazing, I consider it a weekend treatment that just gives you like an extra glow. I don't think it's going to get rid of your fine lines and wrinkles.
It's more like a comprehensive facial.
Yeah. And it's really nice though, because it is targeting the skin a little bit deeper than what a facial can provide. With very limited downtime. And you get on a Friday afternoon, you're ready to go back to work on Monday.
Oh, sure.
So, and it's with numbing cream, it's very tolerable. It takes about 20 to 30 minutes, I think, to give a very thorough treatment as our estheticians do. So, I love it. People come in for it all the time and they rave about it.
And aren't you finding that the patients that are getting CO2 laser, where they're getting like the 96 CO2 laser in the OR, hyperbaric oxygen is really helping get their recovery. They recover a little bit faster.
We are putting them in the chamber for after these treatments, if they're open to it. And I truly do think that it speeds up the recovery.
Yeah, sure.
It expedites the resolution of redness. And as always, with any of these things, if you don't have a solid foundation of skincare, which we're not going to go into today, but if you don't have a solid foundation of skincare, you are not going to heal like we want you to.
Okay, we are at 29 minutes. Your soup is almost done. Your brisket or whatever you're cooking is almost
cabbage.
Done. Anything else?
No, I had such a good time today visiting with everyone, talking about Kygo. I think the myths were very helpful. I took something away from that. And everyone, think about what kind of fall skin laser you need, because we all need it.
And if any of you have any ideas for upcoming topics, send us a DM, and have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap. Remember to share the podcast with your friends. Follow the docs on Instagram at SomnicMD, at Dr. Troy Pittman, and at DC Dynamic Duo. To learn more about the procedures discussed on today's podcast, visit www.somnicpittmanmd.com. That's www.somnicpittmanmd.com.